Welcome to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability. Your hosts are Bill Reed and John Becker, co-authors of the Integrative Design Guide to Green Building. This program will help you take sustainability to the next level. Here are your hosts, Bill Reed and John Becker.
Good afternoon or morning, wherever you may be, everybody. This is Bill Reed and
John Becker. Hi, everyone.
With Building Deeper Green. And here we're talking today. We will be talking with Michael Ogden of Natural Systems International, and the subject is water and understanding water as a living system.
So what's the title of this show? How do we care for water, right?
So what we'll be doing is describing in through the building process, through engagement in design and construction and operating and living in our buildings, how we can think about water differently and how we can address this incredibly important aspect of our lives. You've heard us talk about earth, wind, fire, and water as being those universal elements, and I think we take that for granted. Michael, our guest, loves to say, agua es vida, water is life, Spanish expression. I guess the Italians have a similar one too, right, John?
Acqua la vita, l'acqua la vita.
So around the world, there are cultures that instinctively or, I don't know if it's intuitively, but they certainly embrace the role of water as integral. And it's interesting, and integral to life, it's interesting how we treat water in our culture. We call it stormwater. And for those of you who are in the design business, know that when we're dealing with water, we actually treat it more as a waste. And maybe if we think deeply enough, we might begin to think about where it comes from.
Well, that's actually a pretty important distinction, because remember we talked to Jerry last time, Bill, about habitat primarily. But and with Keith about habitat, and both of them were pretty adamant of the role water plays in the system of life, which is what we're talking about here, which is living systems. And I know, for me, I've really tried to concentrate the last couple of years in being very careful with my word choices. So what, instead of saying stormwater, I'm really trying to be conscious of saying the word rainwater. In fact, the only time I use the word stormwater now, Bill, is when I'm messing with lead credits, right?
Yeah, well, and I even go take it a little further, which is a stretch. I like to call it our drinking water.
Yeah.
Because where do we get our drinking water? Even though the definition of stormwater implies that there's a waste or a toxic or, you know, dirt involved, like brake linings and pollution, oil pollution, gasoline from our streets, nevertheless, if we actually understood the whole cycle, the water cycle, we would be not letting that water run through right into our waste system and into our rivers, bays, and oceans directly from the roads, but we would be doing a lot of different things to it in the meantime.
Well, I think you nailed it. I mean, you nailed it by referring to it as waste. And what we generally do is we treat, as a culture, our water as waste. And I think what we're hearing consistently is that it is perhaps our most valuable resource. Hence, we really need to shift our minds in thinking about it, and sometimes just the words we use can help us get there, because they really impact our beliefs and our attitudes. So if you think about it, we spend all this time, money, effort, infrastructure, getting water, and then what do we do with it? Well, we flush it.
We pay for the privilege of putting it in a concrete pipe and sending it pouring into, polluted into our river.
No, I was going to say, yeah, we do that, but more directly, we create this incredibly wonderful life-giving resource, and then we flush away our urine and our feces with it.
Oh, right.
Does that make any sense to you? I thought that was a pretty perverse construct, but we don't even think about it. It's what we do, right?
Yeah, we don't even think about it. It's just how we were raised, and water was plentiful. Water, we didn't really need to think about it in the past, but now we do. And I'm just going to also, before that, because I feel it's hanging, is that there are others that would say water is not the most important resource, but soil is the most important resource. And I think we need to make sure, but then we could say the sun is the most important resource. So in reality, what we need, or air, and in fact, it's all of those. We can't separate them. But we certainly know that we can't live for more than a couple of days without water. So it's a fair thing to say that it is vital.
So just as a reminder, what we're doing over this these four episodes is dealing with the four key subsystems, as we've been calling them, that make up the whole, so we can understand the pieces to understand the whole. So maybe a way to talk about this is since there are those four key subsystems of habitat, water, energy, and materials, Bill, what would be a good story to tell that might show us how some of these are connected?
Well, there's one that always
entering
comes
it through water, right? Because we can enter the system through any one of these, yeah?
Yeah. All right, well, so let's talk about what my favorite water example. You know what that one is, right, John?
It's the desalination plant.
Desalination plant in Massachusetts.
Yeah. Yep, have at it.
More than a couple. Can I tell that one?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Okay. So there's a town in Massachusetts, and anybody who lives here probably will know where it is, but it's down south where it's sandy soil. They get 45 inches of rain a year, and yet they're spending and have spent $20 million on a desalination plant. Now, that's a pretty remarkable statistic. In fact, it really bothers me because that money to pay for that has come out of my back pocket as a taxpayer in Massachusetts. I called up the town manager the day that I read about this about 4 years ago and said, you know, I could save you $18 million or thereabouts and you'd have fresh water forever. And he hung up the phone on me. Now, I was kind of in an angry mood, so I don't blame him for doing that. But
wait a minute, did you say it angrily?
I was perturbed, let's say. And, you know, it's interesting. He'd probably spent years going through this, and he didn't want to hear another argument about...
Oh, another crackpot from down the street, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, but here's how it would work. Where do we get our fresh water? Where do we get our drinking water? Play the game with me here, John.
From a well.
Nope, doesn't go... Well, if there's a hydrological cycle, of course, so it's a cycle. But if we think about it, wherever, you know, it evaporates from the ocean, the water's in the ocean, it evaporates, it goes up into clouds, and then it rains.
Well, it's essentially rain, but that's where that rain finally kind of goes, right?
Yeah, but the rain's pretty dirty these days.
Yeah, you can't drink it.
And when it goes through roads and rivers and, I mean, other maybe polluted landscapes, it may be dirty. So how does the water get clean in the well?
It filters through healthy soil that contains microbes in it.
Right. And how does the soil maintain its health?
By a series of aeration via the microbes collecting around the root structures of plants.
That's one of many, right? Bears crapping in the woods, animals dying, leaf duff. All those microbes and mycelium are conspiring in this web of life to clean the water, and then we put our straws in the ground, and we suck them up, and we suck that water up and use it. The thing is, we don't return that water.
Well, furthermore, we build all this stuff that has impervious surfaces like driveways and parking lots and roofs, and we send it away?
Right, so we send it away. We pay for the privilege of sending it away, but so what I was trying to tell this manager in this town is that if you actually just expose the sandy soil in a number of places where it had been paved over or built over and recharge the groundwater, you'd actually have a continuous cycle of water forever.
So that kind of leads us to Michael's work, right?
I think so.
What, Michael? We'd like to ask you to join us. Bill, could you quickly introduce Michael for us?
Sure. Michael Ogden has been a friend of mine for, oh my goodness, Michael, how long? Maybe 10, 15 years?
Oh, no, it's got to be longer than that. I'm thinking South Carolina.
Yeah, where we met each other at a conference. And Michael has been my go-to guy for water ever since. It's been a really fun friendship and professional relationship. And Michael is the president and founder of Natural Systems International, and they are experts at using nature, if you will, or natural processes to treat water instead of all the chemicals and machinery. And we're going to be getting into that, the impact of all those chemicals and machinery and energy on treating water. Michael, anything else you want to add to that I might have missed?
No, that's good. That's a good one.
All right. So, maybe just to get into this before the first break, when did you discover that this was you're going to be your life's work?
Well, of course, I'm a civil engineer, and the water lab at where I went to school as an undergraduate in Berkeley had a great water lab. So, we got to play in that and had great fun. And also, I think as a kid, I remember playing in the water a lot. So I think I just kind of moved this direction over time. But there was a significant moment where I realized I had to spend all my time doing it. I was fly fishing in the Colorado Rockies, standing in a small stream, catching native trout and releasing them, and looking at my surroundings in this absolutely crystal clear water, and realize there is not very much of this left any place in the world. And it just turned my focus around. I had three children at the time, and realized, you know, this is the most important thing that I could do. And having as a child played in the water, and then also living in the desert, you begin to get a different sense of the importance of water than folks back east do. So it was a sort of a consequence and a coming together of all these elements at the same time. Kids playing in the water, trout fishing, and living in the West, and realizing
so
water
Michael, what
is an issue.
What do you do in your work now to help preserve water, since there's so little of it? And hopefully we can get to some point in this conversation how much is left. But let's find out first, what do you do?
Well, John, we're primarily an engineering firm. But what we've done is, as a firm, specialize in applying the ecologies of the pond, the marsh, and the meadow. It's where the name comes from. It's a term of art developed by the U.S. EPA. We are ecological engineers, if you will, and our job is to make sure that we maximize the resource efficiency, make the best use of water, using the kinds of things we learn as engineers, as well as what we've learned becoming students of wetlands or the biology and the ecology of these different natural systems.
Would it be fair to say that you guys figure out ways to take polluted and dirty water and make it clean, potable, and fresh without using chemicals?
Certainly, that's true. We avoid chemicals, and we also like to avoid using any machinery if at all possible.
Now, here's the reaction that most people have to that. Well, that sounds pretty voodoo-like or squishy or, you know, very very nice and idealistic. But you're calling yourself an engineer, Michael.
Sure. Gravity. People still remember gravity, I hope. You know, that's a possibility.
Yeah, gravity's our friend.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And water runs downhill, right?
Yeah.
So we can take advantage of that when we design wastewater treatment systems. There's a couple basic ideas here. You know, one of the things I like to tell my engineers is the second law of thermodynamics is that every kilowatt of electricity we can save postpones the heat death of the universe. And although that might seem as an extraordinary claim, it isn't indeed true, and it makes us look at everything we do as, one, not using any chemicals because they're not necessary, and two, is how can we minimize the total energy content as we move water around, clean it up, treat it, deal with it as part of the stormwater treatment process, or even pump it up in buildings. So all of these concepts, one is passive treatment using gravity, thereby minimizing the use of machinery and relying on natural systems because they are self-maintaining, self-organizing.
Okay, that's a perfect place to break.
Yes.
So we can come back then and talk about how these natural systems can purify our water. And we'll be back in a few minutes. You're listening to Building Deeper Green with Bill Reed and John Becker. Be back in a minute.
Are you a wildfire survivor? Do you need help but don't know where to turn? SoCalHelp.org is a place you can go to get immediate help with food, shelter, important medications, and start getting your life back on track. Get help now with insurance, legal issues, and find professional help like doctors and counselors. You can also connect with other survivors and people who can help. For the answers and support you need to rebuild, visit SoCalHelp.org.
Many designers are adapting their design process. They are developing methods to address the environmental impact of their work. Graphic, industrial, interior, architectural, landscape, identity, and fashion designers share a common experience. By revealing the thought processes of people from a wide range of design disciplines, your understanding of sustainable design strategies will deepen. Join us every Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific, for Design Evolution on the Green Talk Network.
America is facing a skilled workforce shortage. SkillsUSA can help. What is SkillsUSA?
SkillsUSA is life-changing.
SkillsUSA is awesome.
SkillsUSA is one of the biggest opportunities life can give you.
SkillsUSA is amazing.
SkillsUSA is motivating.
SkillsUSA specifically prepares you for the workforce.
SkillsUSA empowers students to connect with a network of people, starting with their classmates, to their advisors, to other people in their states. SkillsUSA allows students to connect with business and industry, to manage their education, and to really get a feel of the real world. I'm doing something now that's going to be applicable in the real world, and those skills are going to be useful today in school and in 5 years when I'm working and for the rest of my life.
SkillsUSA champions at work.
On the web at skillsusa.org.
At the Green Talk Network, our experts want to hear your voice. Do you have a question or comment for our hosts? Call us toll-free, 1-888-346-9141. That's 1-888-346-9141. The Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, everyone. We're talking today with Michael Ogden from Natural Systems International. And Michael left off by telling us that much of their work is around creating fresh water using natural systems to do that. So, Michael, how do you do that? What's an example of using natural systems to clean our water?
All right. So the way we do it is using the applied ecologies of the pond, the marsh, the meadow. And when you look at these things, there's actually engineering equivalents of them. So, for example, a septic tank is the bottom of the pond. So that's the first choice. We like septic tanks or fancy term, anaerobic digesters, because they're passive. The next treatment step that we like to use is our wetlands. These are the marshes that are throughout the world, and the work is based upon a woman biologist at the Max Planck Institute in the 50s.
So, Michael, are these wetlands that you're creating, or are these wetlands that already exist?
No, we are usually, almost invariably, relying on man-made wetlands. They're not quite the same. We are not as good as Mother Nature is, but we can apply the basic ideas and principles and use the local native plant community to create a wetlands.
And you put these wetlands, then, Michael, in a bed, right, that doesn't leak?
That's correct.
Okay.
And they could be surface flow or subsurface flow. The idea is that the water from primary treatment, which might be a septic tank, flows through these things, and the microbial community working in a symbiotic relationship with the plants, basically converts the compounds that are in the waste stream entering this into benign compounds, primarily ending up with H2O, maybe a little bit of hydrochloric acid, a little bit of nitrate, a little bit of ammonia at the end.
I mean, this is at the end of the wetland itself.
It's at the end of the wetlands itself.
So the water coming out of the wetland is what I understand is what we used to call tertiary.
Yes.
Tertiary level, so it's swimming pool quality water.
Well, it's almost as good as swimming pool. Let's be clear that there's another step that we need to do to get an even more advanced level, which is the one that you might associate with swimming pools.
Okay, now this is all happening below grade, right? So this is not standing water.
It could be surface too, John. We have both possibilities. One is a surface flow wetlands looks like the ones that you might see in your backyard back east, or there's a subsurface flow where we're running the water through the gravel bed. Okay, so just imagine a big bathtub where it's filled with gravel and a bunch of plants in it, and the water's running through from one end to the other. That's a subsurface flow. Now, surface flow would be that big bathtub with soil in it, and the plants stuck in the soil, and there might be 18 inches of water on top of the soil.
Okay,
so two kinds, different uses, but both relying on the ecologies of the wetlands environment. So it's
now, one of the things, just I want to interrupt, because Michael and I were working on a project at one time, and the big concern that people had is I don't know if you remember that fellow, Michael, who turned red in the face because he was so upset that we were introducing West Nile virus.
Oh, yeah.
And what he didn't understand was that the water was all subsurface. The mosquitoes didn't have a chance.
That's true. It turns out even in the surface flow systems, that control of the mosquitoes can be done very, very effectively, and in fact, much more effectively than spraying, when you use natural controls like bacteria or mosquito hawks, which is a technique used in Louisiana, for example. So there's ways to control West Nile virus and the mosquito breeding population. One is, as you've mentioned, subsurface flow, no water contact, or surface flow with lots of natural predators.
Okay, so I'm a guy who, let's say, wants to build a building, let's say bigger than a house. I'm assuming, of course, these are applicable to larger scale buildings. They're scalable, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And houses, too.
Yep, but houses, too. How expensive is this relative to putting in, let's say, a standard septic system if I am talking about a house?
Well, let's talk about the relative water quality first. Let me just add the final two steps of the natural systems. One is we like to polish the water off from the wetlands with a sand filter, okay? And then, which is the ecology of the riparian corridor. It's the sand and gravel along the banks of a river or stream. The next one is the land application. We want it to go into a meadow or a woodland. So, and there are reasons for this. The healthy soils basically finish the job for us and truly make it drinking water when you go down a few feet in the soil. So going back to costs.
Well, can I just ask one question, though?
Because yeah.
You raised something pretty interesting there. That means, then, that if, in fact, you are infiltrating that water that has been, let's call it, first cleaned, then polished with the sand, et cetera, infiltrated into the site, if, in fact, you now have a well that is drawing water out of the aquifer to which that water is providing supply, you've just created an extraordinarily exquisite and elegant, almost closed loop, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And the input is rain.
It is indeed. Especially if we caught it on the roof of that house and used it inside the buildings, we would have a closed loop.
And now it gets, you know, the old main joke is that the farmer's cesspool ran dry, and he stopped using his cesspool and his well ran dry.
Yeah.
Now we don't need to worry about that anymore.
there's a clear connection to energy here, then, because if in fact the only energy used is to pump the water out of that well, we're bypassing all of that water, all that energy that's used to pump water through the municipal system.
Yes, and that's a big focus for us in terms of a goal. There's a connection between water, food, and energy. And you could imagine that if we cut back on energy, we might also cut back on atmospheric carbon. And the amount, by the way, is for every kilowatt, it's about 0.78 pounds of carbon. So if I can cut back on my wastewater treatment plant energy requirements, I also save on atmospheric carbon. And we also happen to have here a carbon sequestering system because we're enhancing the growth of the forest or the meadow, and what we're generating is wonderful biomass that sequesters the carbon.
Yeah, you know, Michael, someone told me recently that somewhere on the order of, I'm going to ask you what you know about this, somewhere on the order of 5-7% of all of our energy in the U.S. is used to pump water.
Yeah, I think it's more like 20%.
When you count sewage treatment and that?
Well, all movement of water. Irrigation uses most of the water in the United States, about 80% of our total water. So moving that water around, is whether it's for irrigation systems or a city like Phoenix or Los Angeles, for example, or even Boston, you know, there is some pumping required, and especially, you know, you can imagine how much energy it takes to pump water up a 50-story building.
Yeah.
So it's about 20% is the numbers that I use. It's a good rule of thumb. And also to remember, as part of this, that most of the energy is used is to irrigate with. About 80% of the water in the United States is used for irrigation.
Yeah. In fact, here's another one for you. See if you can verify this for me. I believe I saw this on the Department of Energy's website.
That
it takes something like 2-3 kilowatt hours of energy to produce every gallon of potable water we drink.
As a treatment system, yeah, that would as a good average, that would make sense.
Now this ties into soil. You know, we talked at the beginning of this program about the nature of how water is connected, this whole waste treatment system that you're talking about, Michael, is we're not sending the effluent down to the bottom of the water system. We're actually holding it up higher.
Where it belongs. Yeah, let's just talk briefly about that. That's a good one, Bill. One of the things that we know is that the soils will remove antibiotics. So suppose your community has some people take antibiotics. Typically, it goes right through the conventional wastewater treatment processes. And those antibiotics, as you've probably recently read, every one of our streams except the Gila River in New Mexico has antibiotics in it. Well, if you put those same antibiotics in the soil, the bacteria, not surprisingly, I suppose, if you think about it a minute, actually break down those antibiotics. So the soil is real important here in that final treatment process. So when you look at that particular approach to doing stuff, what you see is we're not only enhancing carbon removal from the atmosphere because we're making things grow faster, but we can also put the nitrogen and phosphorus that are in water, instead of attempting to remove it all, put it on the landscape and help grow stuff.
Instead of adding artificial fertilizer.
Exactly. And instead of discharging it downstream, think about the ethical issue here, that basically all our streams and rivers and lakes are essentially sewers. We don't clean everything out of the water because that's not what we're required to do. We just clean up most of it. But the rest of it, and all of those new things that we're discovering in water, all go downstream to the next guy.
Well, then here's the other dimension, is that you have, that you're also, and I want you to talk about this, you're holding back all of the effluent in solids in the septic tank and in the wetland itself, right?
That's correct.
So those then can be applied more easily back to the soil where
yes.
we originally got it. I mean, the peppers and the bananas and the fruit that we're eating basically are soil in our body that need to be returned, or else we actually lose the soil.
Yes. Okay, so what you're telling me here is we've got one system that cleans water, gives us nutrients that we can add to the soil without using fertilizer, removes antibiotics and other chemical pollutants to our water sources, and uses less energy. Now you're going to tell me it's really expensive.
It's less. It's less. It's typically what we see is that the construction costs are about 80%. Of conventional systems when we're talking a small community-scale project.
You know, when you say a small community-scale project, you
mean... Yes, less than 50,000 people.
All right, so a small sewage treatment plant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, a couple million gallons a day or 4 million gallons a day, something like that. So...
What about operating it, Michael?
Well, operating is really quite amazing. Several of the projects, well, more than several, many of them have reported back to us on energy use. In fact, surprisingly, we're one of the few firms that actually does that all the time. But basically what we're hearing is that the energy use is 10 to 15% of conventional technology. Now, there's a penalty for this, which is that we need more land. Okay, so we're changing land for energy. That's the exchange. But the land is a one-time cost, whereas the energy is a continuous, ongoing, in perpetuity cost. And, of course, every kilowatt of electricity, a certain amount of that is generated by fossil fuel plants, and it goes up into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. So the goal ought to be to move us away from energy-intensive treatment processes to passive...
Biological
processes.
You just
absolutely,
made another
because of all the other benefits that happen. Now, it's hard to change over the city of Houston, but in fact, the U.S. EPA gave us guidelines about decentralization, the same thing that happened with computers, for example. Do we need to put all the stuff in one great big room and turn in your box of punched cards like we used to do many years ago? No. Everybody's got a portable computer on their desk, and we could do the same thing with wastewater treatment. Now, hey, it's going to take 40 years probably before we even get people thinking in large-scale terms that way, unless oil prices go back up to $150.
So
all right, Mike, we have to take a break here in a second.
Okay, yeah. So let's talk about that. That's where
really
we want to leave off. Sorry, John.
Yeah, what you just said, I think, is critical to our discussion, and that is, you just said it was going to take us 40 years. My question is, based on what you just described to me, it makes perfect sense. Why is it going to take 40 years? But if you could hold on to that question, we have to take a break, and we'll be back talking with our guest today, Michael Ogden from Natural Systems International, about water.
In a second.
What can you tell me about SkillsUSA?
SkillsUSA teaches you employability skills. So you know how to deal with people, you have teamwork, your resume is going to look awesome.
Well, it's important to know your technical skills, but not only that, to have soft skills, the skills of learning how to communicate with people.
SkillsUSA champions at work.
On the web at SkillsUSA.org.
Can we recognize our world not as a commodity, but as a sacred creation that will support us best the more creatively we live on it? Green Visions is all about how a spirit of innovation and pleasure can be brought into solving our environmental problems. Join your host, Carolyn North, each week as she talks about what citizens of the world are doing to make a difference. Heal the planet, heal yourself, and have a good time doing it. Tune in to Green Visions with Carolyn North every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Green Talk Network.
Hey, y'all. This is Stephen Cochran. As a country artist, I have traveled around this great country of ours, often meeting our brave men and women in uniform. And as a Marine and veteran of both the Iraq and Afghan conflict, I know how important it is to thank our troops who defend our freedom each and every day. One of the best ways to thank them is to give their children and spouses the gift of education. Scholarships for 2 years, 4 years, and vocational school. This is exactly what a national charity, Thanks USA, does. Please go to their website, www.thanksusa.org, to make a generous donation to the Thanks USA Scholarship Fund for the families of the troops, and I thank you.
Keep listening to the Green Talk Network for the latest in the sustainability and green movement for all of our futures, today and tomorrow. The Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Hey, and welcome back all to Building Deeper Green with John Becker and Bill Reed, and we are interviewing Michael Ogden, a biological natural systems treatment, water treatment expert. And where we left off is, why is it going to take 40 years for people to adopt incredible technologies that is less expensive to build and better for the environment? It's kind of mind-boggling, but we know change is hard. But what are the specifics, Michael?
Give you two examples. First, we have to remember that DNA wasn't discovered until 1953. So biology is a relatively new subject, and engineers, especially my generation, those are guys that are running the current firms, never had biology cars. Most of us didn't anyway. We thought of it as the soft science. What do those guys know, right? Well, that's all changing. The other one is to recognize that when James Watt started his steam engine until a turbine propulsion system was developed, took from about 1750 to 1905. So technology advances slowly, and it requires not only the educational system to change, for example, the way we teach engineers, but it also takes time for the construction industry, the builders, the operators, and the general knowledge
so, Michael,
about
how many
systems and biology to come into the community as a whole. Now, you think about it, we're still arguing about evolution in this country. I mean, that's why I say it's at least 40 years.
Yeah.
How many civil engineers are taught biology in their training?
It's more common now. I had 20 pages of it when I was an undergraduate.
Did you say 20 pages?
20 pages of biology, yes.
Out of a 5-year degree?
Yes.
So, not much.
Not much, and you have to think about that.
I
love to tell the story that I took a class on ecology outside of the curriculum, the general curriculum. I got credit for it. It was called Ecology, the Subversive Science.
Really?
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's the name of the textbook, yeah. So, just thinking about that, you know, that was 40 years ago. And now the people that I can hire that are recent graduates, there are more and more young engineers who get educated in natural systems. It's a great concept. It goes back to 1970 to a guy named Maxwell Small at the Brookhaven National Labs who came up with the concept, which is of the definitions of what it is. I mean, here it is almost 40 years later. We're still grappling with this, and it is a slow process.
So what do the communities grapple with that you're talking with, Michael? What are their hang-ups?
There's a real interesting thing that goes back to the Clean Water Act, which is basically we set up a procedure to finance these wastewater treatment plants that says, hey, we don't care how much they cost, just make clean water. And we developed these technologies that are energy inefficient and had no price limits on them. It's like we're doing now for energy, basically, with alternative green energy stuff. Hmm. And as a consequence, we didn't have to pay attention to what things cost. And as things progressed, we developed a fee structure for public works that we actually had it in place that we applied to wastewater treatment systems that said, hey, we will get X percentage of the construction costs for engineering fees. There was no reason now to go to more efficient, less costly technologies.
Michael, isn't there...
That's still in place, by the way.
Yeah, and it strikes me as if maybe this is an extraordinary opportunity right now, because I keep reading about, because of the time that's passed since most of these fundamental water infrastructures were installed, that they're all in really bad shape.
Yes.
Almost throughout the U.S., particularly on the East Coast, right?
Oh, sure. I mean, you got systems that are 200, 300 years old, and they're being held together with duct tape and wire.
Yeah, but why? Just think about it. Here I am, a big international engineering firm. Why should I give up $100 billion worth of infrastructure work if I can add the associated fees when I could do the same thing for, let's say, a fraction of that, maybe $50 billion?
So there's no incentive in the system.
What's the incentive for the engineering firm to come up with more cost-effective ways? Now, George Jabonagos, who is the author of four or five textbooks, has suggested that we ought not to select or limit the engineers on the basis of the fees, but on the life cycle costs. So here's the real opportunity, John, as I think, is to say, look, don't pay us based upon what the construction cost is, but pay us on the man hours it takes to do the job, and give us an incentive so if we can say, hey, look, if we do this, we'll save the community X dollars over the course of the next 50 years of this system.
Yeah, Michael, it's exactly the same perverse disincentive as an architect that we
face. Yeah, of course,
The less it costs, the less we get in fees.
Yeah, why do it? Especially if I'm the principal of a firm and I'm 60 years old and I can sit there and say, what the hell are these young guys talking about here? This is what, green technology, natural systems? Come on.
Well, here's the other thing, Michael.
It doesn't work.
We have a general predilection in our society to buy things, right? Give me a bright, shiny object.
Sure.
And so an engineer comes along and says, I'm going to give you a bright, shiny object. It does all that, and it's affordable. And you're coming along and saying, here, we'll give you a plant.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a landscape now. That's right, and it's non proprietary technology. It's all public domain stuff. There's no marketing budget associated with it. You know, it's not like I can be GE and sell a membrane bioreactor and have a piece of shiny equipment that I can get everybody to use.
So, Michael, are you seeing a shift in the desire for a green plant instead of a mechanized plant?
Yeah, sure. You know, John, that. The USGBC definitely started us in the right direction that way. And Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth certainly helped in that. And certain people who have, I suppose if they can look out the window and see trees, they probably understand what we're talking about. And it's just a slow process, John. It's just a slow process, you know. And we just have to recognize that change can... You know, it's hard to move all of these industries. Not only engineers that got to move; it's the suppliers, it's the contractors, it's the municipalities who end up operating them. It takes time.
Well, here's a question for you that we get asked fairly frequently when we propose constructive treatment wetlands, and I want to get a really clear answer to this. A lot of folks will say, "Well, gee, John, what happens when the system freezes in the wintertime, because I practice in the Northeast.
Yeah, it's a good question. And, in fact, it goes back to basic biology again. The original idea about microbial growth goes back to a guy named Arrhenius, and I think it's in the late 1700s. He noticed cultures of bacteria growing faster when it was warmer. Well, so when it's cold, things slow down, just like you and me. So we design for the worst-case condition. We design for January. And as a consequence, it has to be larger because things slow down. But that's the design condition. Typically in the Northeast, to deal with the wintertime conditions, it's 2.5 times larger than it would be if we could design just for the summer condition.
But what about freezing, Michael?
You know what? The Norwegians got them above the Arctic Circle.
So the heat, for the body heat, if you will, or the decomposing...
It's called the heat of fusion of water. It takes a lot of heat out of the water to get it to freeze. And the water coming out of a house, even in the, you know, above the Arctic Circle, is still about 60 degrees. So with a little bit of thought, you can figure out what you need to take care of stuff. And it does slow down, no question about it. But you design for that condition. By the way, time is another significant issue. A typical mechanical system takes 8 hours to do its job. We're talking about a minimum of 3.5 days, sometimes as much as 6.5 days, to do the treatment job. And the reason we argue for the longer time is that there are some chemicals that are in the waste stream, like Prozac, like antibiotics, like all the personal care pharmaceuticals, which do not break down in 8 hours. They make it right through the system, and we are becoming aware of them. We've always known that they were there. It was the question of about how to detect them. And that process has improved greatly. So we know they're in the water, and we know some of their effects. So the question is, how do you get rid of them? And can you do it in 8 hours? No, you can't. Some compounds just take longer. So that time factor becomes really important, as does the temperature.
Okay, well, that leads to another question, then. This sounds like it's this kind of a natural constructed wetlands treatment system is highly applicable to most projects. However, there might be some where it might not be. For example, let's say a medical lab where you've got pathogens, et cetera, going into the waste stream. Or,
you know, we've got one, John, of an AIDS hospital in India, and they've been testing for discharge of viruses. It's a non-issue. And the reason is, because the time frame, you know, we're talking a minimum of about 3.5 days in most wetlands. And viruses are basically particles that happen to be food, depends upon who you are. So the viruses settle out. They get attached by electric charge differences to roots or the soils, and they degrade or they get eaten. Their DNA and RNA, well, actually, they're all RNA and a little bit of protein. So that's food for somebody. In fact, predation is the primary method of disinfection for all of the pathogens, whether it's salmonella or cholera or any of the viruses. They're food, and if you just keep them there long enough, we can see lots of testing on this. They become food for somebody else in this process, in effect. And the DNA or RNA is simply rearranged by the organism that's predating the pathogen.
So the food cycle is actually pretty interesting thing to talk about. And I don't know if we have time before the break, but you've often said, Michael, that plants live on carbon and water, as I recall. I may be making
it. And nitrogen and phosphorus, sure.
Yeah, and what does the human body produce?
The same.
So that's a pretty symbiotic relationship.
Absolutely. I like to make a triangle that's water, food, and energy.
Yep,
and
sun. Got to remember the sun.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Well, right. But we're talking about just the flow, the flows and processes of stuff on the earth right now. The wetland and humans is actually an incredibly symbiotic interrelationship.
Yeah, once you begin to recognize that it is cyclic, you know, there's this, as John put it, the external energy put from the sun, but then the relationship of food and water, obviously, and keeping the cycle going with what would happen in a natural system like a prairie animals.
Michael, on that note, we're going to take a break, and
okay.
We'll be back.
All right.
Be back with Building Deeper Green, everybody.
Attention swimmers, get out of the water. Everybody, out of the water immediately.
Dude, is that...
It's a pair of thunder thighs. Big ones, too. That mom, who's been swimming a lot with her kids, must have lost them.
Whoa. I heard about this happening once up at Laguna.
Small step number 54. Play with your kids. It's just one of the many small steps you can take to get healthy. Learn more at www.smallstep.gov.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Are you thinking green? How do you make your home, family, and life green? Green Today with host Nelson Martinez aims to answer these questions and more. Look to the show as your guide to everything green, from the global movement to what's going on in your neighborhood. We can all do a little something to help our local environments and the planet as a whole by being smarter consumers and using products that are less harmful. Listen for Green Today with Nelson Martinez, Mondays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, on the Green Talk Network.
In the great scheme of things, a minute isn't all that much, unless you happen to have a stroke. All of a sudden, those minutes count. Minutes that could mean losing your ability to talk, move, or walk. Which is why, if you can get help in time, your stroke can be treated. The warning signs of a stroke include sudden numbness or weakness of the face. If you experience this, call 911 immediately. Visit strokeassociation.org or call 1-888-4-STROKE today. A public service announcement from the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Thank you for listening to the Green Talk Network. Help to spread the green by involving your family and friends. You're doing your part. Now help them think green. Spread the green. The Green Talk Network.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, everyone. We were having a conversation just before the break with our guest, Michael Ogden, and he was concluding or discussing how there's an extraordinary symbiotic relationship between the cycles of these natural systems that can treat water and human systems. So, Michael, tell us a little bit more about that, because I think maybe one of the things we're struggling with is how do we get folks in, let's say, a municipality or a community to recognize this and say, yeah, gee, that's a good idea.
I think it comes from the basic lessons of ecology. When you study ecology, you recognize it's we're all in this together. The very straightforward idea you can see of animals grazing on the prairie, the buffalo, for example, going up and down as they used to, that their waste fertilized the grasses, which they came back and ate on their next round trip. And essentially, that's where we need to get to. That our relationship to nature is not separate, that in fact we are part of this cycle, and that understanding natural systems and how they work means that you begin to integrate things like the waste stream, and it no longer is a negative word, it becomes a positive word because it's a resource stream. It's got carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and all the stuff that life needs. So how do we use it?
So how do you bridge that with an engineer? Now, most of the committees that are approving these things are engineers that come from a traditional school. How do you bridge that?
Well, there was always a certain number of people that were interested in it. George Tabanoglos, Woody Reed, Bob Knight, Bob Cadillac. These guys had been doing this stuff for years. Bob Gerhard out, and a lot of Bobs in this, out in Arcata, California, had always been interested in these kinds of things. And it was going particularly from an energy perspective. These were just made a much more intelligent way of doing that. And every engineer ought to be concerned about the energy aspects of the treatment facility. So these guys were pushing it. We saw it in EPA manuals, in textbooks. It is the next step, which is the hardest one, is this economic switch. So on the other side, we have the community that's spending dollars, and initially people would come to us solely on the basis of economics. Hey, this was cheaper, and they could understand that the operational cost, if the guy only needs to be there 15 minutes a day and isn't doing anything, that the operational costs become important to the community. So those communities that educated themselves and were receptive to somebody like me who was able to tell the story coherently, we could come forward and say, look, it's in EPA manuals and standard engineering textbooks. There are people that know how to do this. Here's how we'll hold your hand to get you through this process.
So, Michael, just to show folks that this is real, can you name just a few of those communities with which you've worked and installed these systems?
Oh, sure. There's there's literally hundreds of them, not only my firm, but other firms as well, like North American Wetlands. Bob Cadillac started off in Michigan. We did the city of Mandeville, a small subdivision outside of
Orleans, right?
Yeah, these are all wetlands treatment systems. City of Mandeville was a wetland system. City of Jerome, Arizona. The city of Phoenix has a tertiary wetlands. City of Beaumont, Texas. Orlando, Florida, Iron Bridge Wastewater Treatment Plant. I don't know, we've done 500 projects over the years, John. It's hard for me to remember all of them.
That's all I wanted to hear. One of the stories that I love from work that you guys did was in New Jersey, where it was actually cheaper to do this significantly than a standard septic system because of the clay construct of the soils.
Yes.
Talking about the Willow School.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep, that was because what we did two things there at the Willow School. One is that we made the water cleaner than the local standards, and the second one was showed people that by taking advantage of the clay soil, it's no longer a bad thing. It's that if you clean it up so it's like rainwater, then we are to a place where the water percolates freely into the soil and recharges the aquifer with clean water as opposed to high nitrate content.
Michael, one last question for you. You started off by saying you got into this by recognizing what little water we had available.
Yes.
Can you quantify that for us in simple terms that all of us can understand?
Sure. There's two issues, I think. One is the way it's being used. For example, 60% of the water use in residential for people in the United States primarily is for irrigation. And that's a form of madness that we're using potable water to irrigate. On the planet, about 0.7% of the water is fresh water. The rest of it is either locked up in ice or is seawater. So what we have available to us is, of course, makes a big difference where you are. If you're in Libya, there isn't very much. If you're in Canada, there's a heck of a lot more. So it's distribution is the issue. And out west, the distribution is erratic, and in many cases, it's might be 4 inches of rain per year or less.
So you're saying that we basically should be use a distributed system rather than a central system, which would allow the water not to have to be sent all over the place.
Yeah, when you look at the cost of a system like the California Aqueduct Project or CAP, Central Arizona Project, or the State Water Project for California, SWP, each of those systems, about 28% of their budget or 32% of their budget is just to pump the water through the system.
Yeah.
And then the economic effects of that are basically, all the water's going south into Los Angeles to have those incredible landscapes people have there that are just crazy in the sense of what the loss means for agricultural uses or in a natural discharge to the San Francisco Bay and what it means to the fish population.
Well, what I love about this, Michael, is that you've given us some sane solutions to that kind of craziness. And we really thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
See you later, Michael.
All right, Bill.
Thanks.
Bye.
Wow. What do you think about?
So what it says to me, and I've been working with these systems for a number of years, but learned some things from this, from just talking with Michael again, always do, but how powerful, what I loved at the beginning of this was the idea that the septic system and the marshland and the sand filters and the soil filters are just basically, it's duplicating the natural system that exists already, but just as an engineered entity. And as a result, all that science has been done. What is, I like what Gene Benyus and Gil Friend say, that nature has 3.8 billion years of experience. You know, why not use it?
Yeah. Well, and what I loved, although I was relatively familiar with these types of systems, I'd never completely thought through, and obviously still haven't, but the different connections between the systems that, the way Michael talks about it, in terms of supplying nutrients for food,
mm-hmm.
cleaning water to stay healthy, cleaning the air, actually, via that transpiration component, as well as the reduction of the amount of energy that is required, hence not only pollutants from burning the fossil fuels we use, would have had to use, as well as the reduction in CO2, and in fact, feeding the plants to make habitat healthy. Bill, look at the hole here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a super integrated system.
Yeah, it's like the whole hole.
Yeah, and what's remarkable about it is you need to spend less money to do it. And you would have remarkable habitat out your front window or side window. And one of the things that Michael didn't address that always comes up is the idea of smell and odor.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that in the wetlands, as he's explained it to me, is that what most of the odor is in the anaerobic treatment in the septic tank. But the remaining odor that comes into the wetland is actually, there's about a 4-inch gap between the bottom of the water, the top of the water, and the top of the stones. And in that, there are microbes that actually eat the remaining odor. Pretty elegant system.
Well, and since so many folks are concerned about energy, the notion that we can be significantly more conserving of our energy with these kinds of systems is actually a pretty good segue to our next little discussion here, right?
So climate change and carbon and global warming and energy use and depleted resources, that's an integrated system, too, that is dependent on a large degree the kind of energy we use in our buildings as well as in our transportation. But we're going to be talking about our buildings and energy use with Marcus Scheffer, also of the Seven Group, a partner of John's, but one of the more skilled energy and daylighting engineers in the country.
So, thanks to Michael, we learned once again, I believe, that to do different things, we need to do things differently.
And to do things differently, we need to think about them differently.
And, of course, to think differently, we need to be different. See you next time, everyone.
Goodbye.
Thank you for tuning in this week to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. Please join us again next Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Green Talk Network, and make it a great and greener weekend.